My word. A panel game devised by Tony Shrine and Edward J. Mason. Dennis Farn and Frank Muir challenge Anscott James and Dennis Norton in a game about words, with Jack Longland in the chair.
And we go straight into the first round, which is about words, and this week, about some newish adjectives which end in ick, I see. And for 2 marks, I want to know their meaning. We begin with Dennis Norton, and yours, Dennis, is anabolic, A-N-A-B-O-L, I see, anabolic.
Not the singular of diabolic, no.
No.
I only know this word in connection with a phrase about anabolic steroids.
That's right.
Which is what those kind of weightlifters and Mr. Universe people, and you get muscles in your eyebrows. But what it does to steroids, or what either of the words mean, I really don't know.
Well, the building up of muscle is a good start, Dennis.
Anabolic must be something to do with throwing, mustn't it?
No, it means, it's a Greek word meaning a heaping up, and that's where the muscles get bigger. 1.5, Dennis.
Hmm.
It's adjective by itself, anabolic, is that which produces or induces chemical changes in living organisms, particularly when it leads to the chemical upbuilding of complex substances. And as you say, weightlifters and shot putters sometimes cheat against their more honest competitors by taking these anabolic steroids. Dennis, yours is cryogenic. C-R-Y-O-G-R-E-N-I-C. Cryogenic.
Well, when I was in Greece a long time ago, the seagulls always said, creo, creo. I used to say it meant cold.
It does. Cold is a good start.
So it's something to do with cold, producing cold, or born in cold. Or something with cold, anyway. It's good enough, isn't it? Yes.
Yes. Any particular sort of branch of science?
Oh, well. The refrigerator.
He'll do. Two. Cryogenic is that which pertains to or is identifiable with low-temperature substances or the apparatus necessary to produce low temperatures, which is your fridge. And it comes, as you say, from a Greek word, kruos, meaning frost.
One of the smaller surprises of my life was to discover that bird's-eye peas... the bird's eye isn't just a trade name, but it is named after the chap who discovered deep freezing on one of those Antarctic expeditions. Mm-hmm. His name was Clarence Birdseye. A round of applause would not be amiss.
Well,
he was actually given the Nobel Peace Prize.
I'd heard about Admiral Byrd at the South Pole, but this Clarence escapes me. But thank you very much. A useful bit of information, Frank. And now it's your turn.
Oh, good.
And your word is bionic.
Bionic is... I know little about this because a chap used to live opposite us at Thorpe who was in bionics. And he was concerned with examining human tissue and structure in order to make computers speak.
Yes, that's about it.
I don't think he's quite got there yet, but he's still at it. And it seems to be an examination of the way animals work, the animal tissues and muscles and so forth, in order to adapt that to mechanical purposes.
Absolutely right, Frank. 2 marks. It's bionics is study of methods of working of living creatures and the application of the principles that you've observed to the design of computers. It sounds to me absolutely dreadful. 2 marks indeed. And Scott James, your word is hydroponic.
When you put your bulbs over their roots to grow into a little pot of water, you're growing them by hydroponics.
Yeah, and it's supposed to have a great future, is that right?
Well, I don't know. It depends on the water supply. It depends on whether soil or water is more readily available in the future.
That's right. 2 marks at once. That which pertains to the cultivation of plants without soil and in water and you then fill up the water with chemicals to make the plants grow. It's Greek words again, meaning water toil, and it must be very like that.
Mm. Actually, in all the science fiction of the 30s, in all the spaceships, they got their vegetables hydroponically,
yes.
So they didn't... it's not that new.
No. Well, before we get on to the next round, here are the quotations for the last round, which I'm giving to Frank Miller and Dennis Norton. And Dennis, yours is, a little touch of Harry in the night. And yours, Frank, none but the brave deserves the fur. Bringing on round two, which is a round of contrived commentary. For 2 marks, I want to comment in a single sentence on a given subject. And your comment must include, in any order, 3 words that I also give you. Back to Dennis Norden again. Dennis, your subject is an organ recital, and your 3 given words are diapason, footwork, and inconsolable.
Diapason.
Footwork.
Footwork. And...
inconsolable.
Can I put in for fringe benefits on this? John Bull, the celebrated John Bull, who is reputed to have composed the melody of our national anthem, one day sat on the keyboard console in order to play a diapason on the foot pedals purely by footwork, thus causing a passerby to say, inconsolable.
Well, I don't think you could have got those 3 words into shorter space than Dennis used there. 2 marks at once. Dennis Bauer, your subject is a swan, and your 3 given words are Pavlova, monogamous, and cob, C-O-B.
Perhaps this should be a kind of look about your nature notebook study.
Yes.
Yes. Address to the class, perhaps. Perhaps I should warn you that a swan is a passionate bird. And I should... and I should go on to say that unlike Pavlova, whose intimate acquaintance with swans was limited to those who are dying, a leader was indecently assaulted by Jupiter in the form of a cob, far from monogamous.
The famous picture of that is called Swan Upping.
Well, after that rapid tour through mythology and ballet, 2 marks again, we pass on to Anne Scott James. And yours, Anne, is a Catherine Wheel. And your given words are centrifugal, scintilla, S-C-I-N-T-I-W-L-A, and martyrdom.
Well, I don't think there's a scintilla of hard evidence to prove that the legend of St. Catherine's martyrdom is accurate and actually happened. But on the other hand, I think it's psychologically quite possible, because I think St. Catherine was somebody very like me, somebody who had absolutely no aptitude at all for mechanics or technology. Because the fact is, as we all know, that when she touched the wheel, it broke.
Yes.
Now I've got to get in centrifugal. You've got
to get in another conjunction.
So therefore, as you were so helpfully saying, Dennis, whenever I see St. Catherine's wheel going round and round, sending off those centrifugal sparks on November the 5th, I think there is a woman who, if she lived today, like me, would be an excellent car driver, but wouldn't have a clue what went on under the bonnet.
Susan Two marks, sad story. Frank Muir, well, your subject is a hammock. And your three given words are dusk, notwithstanding, and full frontal.
They haven't got to be in the same order, have they?
Nope.
I can't write that fast. I'm not saying full frontal. What does that mean?
You don't get the cinema now.
A hammock. A hammock, Jack, sir, is a peculiarly naval device, a kind of bed-like net in which a sailor can retire at dusk, rest his ankles on the hot pipe above the hammock, thus enabling him to see the better, the full sun.
P100.
Among the items
stuck to the bulkhead wall, full frontal, only to find that he has to present himself at sick parade the following morning with sore and painful feet acquired notwithstanding.
Splendid picture of life in the Navy and too odd. Well, now we have a round, a quickie, I think, of etymological imports. For two marks, what's the literal translation of the following foreign words, which are now fairly much accepted into the English language? Dennis Norden, nothing personal here, orangutan.
What does it literally mean?
Mean, that's right.
I don't know. Orangutan. I'll wash you white. I don't know. I suppose it literally meant creature that goes along looking like a man and with a rather roseate rear.
Yes, without being anatomical, you've got half of it right.
Which half did I get right?
The man. Where does he live? Man. Where does he live?
I had a very good definition the other day on that. Clever is believing half of what you read. Brilliant is knowing which half. I don't know what orangutan means.
Well, you've got the man. I'll give you one. It means man of the woods. It's a Malay word, and they're found in Borneo, and I think were found in Sumatra. It's said that the Malays themselves don't use this phrase, orangutan, of this particular ape, but we do. One out of two. To this power, a subpoena, S-U-B-P-O-E-N-A, subpoena, literally.
Subpoena, it means under penalty, it means.
That's right.
Under penalty.
And you use it for what?
You use it for being summoned to give evidence in a legal case that you aren't necessarily willing to take part in.
That's right. Two marks, well described. Frank Muir.
The lawyer was lost in you.
Yes. Frank Muir. Harakiri.
Well, what was the question?
What does it literally mean if you were a Japanese scholar?
It means a particularly nasty and painful way of doing away with yourself.
Yes.
Of ripping yourself up with a knife.
Yes.
Your tummy. Harakiri is the very old Japanese for goodbye acid indigestion.
Frank, it describes the act, which you don't much like, much more accurately than you so far suggested.
Gut slice.
That'll do. Two marks. It means belly cut. And as Frank says, it's ceremony of suicide. And Scott James, negligee, with two E's at the end. Negligee. Literal meaning.
Well, it means, I suppose, that you've neglected when your lover comes to see you. Only you are neglected, aren't you? No, I think it means you've neglected to put on proper clothing. In other words, you're all sort of prepared to throw off.
a little bit. the last little neglected portion of your clothing at the drop of a hat.
Yeah, what does the adjective actually refer to? Is it
the person, do you think, or the garment? I think it's rather negligee.
It refers to the person.
It means the person. Ah, then your lover's abandoned you. Mm. So instead of standing naked in the bedroom, you put your negligee on, bury your face in the pillow, and burst into tears.
Affecting scenes, aren't they?
Yeah. Any good?
Yes, I think it'll do.
Something loose. You slip into something loose.
That's what I wanted. Yes. We won't go any further into that. It means originally careless of one's appearance. In the 18th century, it was a woman's loose, decorative dressing gown of flimsy material, and therefore easy undress. And you can make of that what you like, 2 marks. And we come to the last round, and to Frank and Dennis's quotations, and the marks will be awarded on the length of the applause of the audience here in the theatre. Dennis, your quotation, if you remember, is "A Little Touch of Harry in the Night," which comes from Shakespeare's Henry V.
Let me read you this chap's letter. The envelope's got an Amsterdam postmark, and inside it says, "Dear Mr. Norden, there is an international guide to proprietors of private menageries. It is entitled Who's Zoo? And on perusing it, I noticed with interest that you are now the owner of a collection of wild animals. I wonder if you would be interested in selling them, because having recently had the misfortune to plant all my tulip bulbs upside down, I now have 40 acres of wasteland that would make an excellent safari park. Yours sincerely, etc., etc." Well, talk about a godsend. You don't know how hard it is to get rid of a private zoo. Of course, I should never have accepted it in the first place. You see, what happened was I'd sold my car to this bloke in Hertfordshire, and when I went down to pick up the cash from him, he said he was a bit strapped for ready money, so would I accept his private menagerie instead? Well, I suppose I should have been a bit suspicious, because the car was only a 1953 Wolseley, and all I asked for it was 25 quid. But, you know, I get these impulses, and the idea of owning my own private zoo, especially as I just bought a lightweight safari jacket. So I said, "All right, then, fine." And so he shoved the documents in my hand and scooted off. Well, just a 10-minute tour was enough to show me what I'd let myself in for. This wasn't a zoo. It was a rest centre for animals with psychiatric problems. Every creature in the place was suffering from some kind of personality defect. There was a mountain goat that was scared of heights. A hyena with melancholia. A gazelle that limped. And what could possibly have been the world's only vegetarian piranha fish. To say nothing of a praying mantis that had turned agnostic. And a sheep that was allergic to wool. Even the animal that they call the king of the jungle turned out to be bisexual. Really, the only lion I've ever heard roar with a lisp. Well, as you can imagine, over the next few months, it cost me a fortune, not just in animal psychiatrists, but in the plain ordinary vets as well. That hippopotamus, for instance, every other day he collapsed to the ground with some illness or other. Mind you, personally, I'd say they were all imaginary. I think he's what they call a hypochondriac. It's still no joke trying to treat an unwell hippo, even if he is malingering. That day he had to have one of his teeth taken out. It was a nightmare. Not the actual extraction. That was fairly straightforward. It was the getting him to sit in the chair. So, as I say, you can imagine how glad I was to get this letter that I read you offering to take the lot of them off my hands. And that's why this evening, as soon as it gets dark, all those animals are going to be crated up and sent off down the old Amsterdam Trail. Or as they put it in Henry V, a little Dutch safari in the night.
Does have a tough time, Dennis, doesn't he? And we'll go on to Frank, and his quotation was, "None but the brave deserves the fair."
I want to talk to you tonight about taxicabs and taxi drivers, upon which I am a world authority, having been on a tour of the United States, South Africa, Australia, and New Zealand. About 9/10 of your time is spent either in a taxi cab or trying to find one. And you soon come across the various vagaries which exist in the various countries. New Zealand was very little problem because they have virtually no taxi cabs. Because, well, they don't need to get anywhere, you know, they're there. Africa, where I found taxi drivers were taciturn and very cool. We had a weekend at Chobe Game Reserve, and we had a cab for the night we spent there, driven by a Matabele driver called Ivan. And Ivan was rather afraid of elephant, as I say now, having been to the Chobe Game Reserve. Elephants, I would have said beforehand. But Ivan was rather afraid of elephant. He disliked them under the, no doubt, advised thought that they also disliked him. And we were driving round the trail and suddenly came face to face with a great black bull elephant, and there was thrashing about in the trees beside him. So obviously he had a calf or a wife or something there and didn't like being intruded on by a rather thinly armoured car with my wife and I and Ivan driving. And he drew up, slammed the brakes on. We stopped about 5 foot away from this beast, who lowered his ears forward and made trumpeting noises. And Ivan turned to me and very coolly said, "May I reverse, sir?" I said, "Yes, you may." It's in America that you come up against the taxi problem, because American taxis are not like British taxis. British taxis, as you know, are designed so that a gentleman may sit upright on the back seat in a silk hat. And American taxicabs are frequently yellow and always bent. And they have a bulletproof screen erected between the driver and the passenger so that the driver won't be bopped on the head by a social misfit. Unhappily, the room taken up by this bulletproof screen is most of the room formerly occupied by the passengers. So anybody over the height of 3'6" has to draw himself up into a kind of fetal crouch. You can speak to the... It's just like a gauze thing, but you can speak to him through a kind of square hole. And American taxi drivers are either totally silent, and you just gaze at the back of their necks, and they don't reply at all. Or else they're extremely garrulous, and never stop talking at all. "Hey, you're a stranger, ain't you? What are you, French?" French. One said to me, "Hey, do you know Giraldo?" And I said, "Well, yes, I did, yes." And this chap was a great... He said, "I once drove Giraldo. He was a gentleman.
Giraldo. He said, that was dance music in the 1940s. They don't write dance music like that anymore. He said, hey, fella, do you remember? You stepped out of a dream. And he was turning around and looking at me through this bulletproof gauze. We were careering all down 57th Street, harmonizing. Me and my knees, talking through this grid as though in some weird mobile confessional. I do think it's wrong that American, particularly New York cabbies, inflict on your journey the stories of the trouble they have with their wife, with their teeth, with their feet, and with their taxes. This is totally wrong. They should pay you to listen all that rubbish, as though they were paid for a psychiatrist. I don't even think you should pay them, and I'm totally in agreement with John Dryden. And I'm sure it was New York cabbies he had in mind and their conversation when he wrote, "None but the brief deserve the fare."
Well, ladies and gentlemen, by your vote, Dennis Norden wins the story, but the other team, Dennis Powell and Frank Muir, win the entire contest.
Taking part in My Word were Anne Scott James, Dennis Powell, Dennis Norden, and Frank Muir. The chairman was Jack Longman. The questions were compiled by Peter Moore, and the program was produced by Tony Shryer.
You've been listening to My Word from the BBC, heard each week at this time. This is the WFMT Fine Arts Network.